Welcome, my friends, to the Generations Radio broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host, with you here today in studio. Also, Steve Vaughn, just a couple of dads taking a look at the world through the eyes of a biblical worldview and through the eyes of fathers who are trying to raise their kids in the 21st century during a period of time in which faith, family, and freedom are disappearing from our large institutions but are being salvaged on certain islands here and there throughout the Western world. And the United States is certainly where the battle is raging most ferociously, because the left is making progress here, but there's still something of a pro-life, pro-family, pro-fatherhood approach left in the United States, despite the fact 50% of kids are born outside of wedlock, up from 6% in 1960. Despite the fact that, yeah, okay, we got some struggles. We got some issues that we're struggling through ourselves. But the hope is always in the future. And ultimately, the future is the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the final judgment. Okay, that's where the hope culminates. But we also work for something. We work to disciple the nations. We work for certain goals. We want to disciple some nations somewhere. And if we're backed into certain islands here and there, we're going to disciple those islands, and God will give us whatever blessings He will give us, but we're not going to give up this battle, are we, Steve? Just going to engage it.
Yeah, we've got to face it full on and keep advancing.
And for the time being here in the United States, the millennial generation is not looking very good. That is the next generation. The 18 to 35-year-olds are not looking very good. Now, I happen to be a Gen Xer. Steve, what are you? You're a Gen Xer too, right?
Well, technically, I was
born after 64.
I was born in 64. I was sort of on the last of the
last baby of the boomers,
sort of beginning of the Gen Xers.
Yep. So we're Gen Xers, beginner of the Gen Xers, but the baby boomers end their births end in the 1963, and then the millennial generation probably kicks in the 1980s sometime. But the fact of the matter is, friends, the millennial generation is not looking very good, and we've talked about this a number of times, probably covered 50 stories on this subject, and I've got more stories. I think a story a day is coming out of The Atlantic, coming out of Time Magazine, TheWeek.com, and I'm going to cover some of these stories on this edition of the program because I think this is important. Why? Because the direction of the nation will be set generationally. We have talked about the generation trajectory. You set a generation trajectory, and the way you educate children in the public schools in the 1990s will dictate what happens in the year 2020, 2030. And so if you don't reform the way you educate children in the 1980s, 1990s, and 2000s, you're not going to reform politics by the year 2040, 2050. I'm sorry, just not going to happen unless somebody gets out there into the homeschool circuit, somebody gets out there into the Christian private school circuit, somebody gets out there in the public school circuit and starts teaching a biblical worldview. And gradually, we might see something of a minority of young people salvaged for the next generation. The millennial generation is not looking very good on a number of fronts. Here's the Atlantic Magazine article. I'm going to summarize a 20-page article that came out just yesterday. It says here, a study indicates millennials are deeply confused about their politics, finances, and culture. They're confused. They're just really, really confused. And here's kind of a summary of their confusion. This generation, very negative on the economy, but they're the most optimistic generation in the country. Hard to take that. They're very confused. They're very confused, Steve. The most technologically connected generation in modern history, which means that their name is on every single hard drive in the country, but they're the least trusting of any generation in the country today. Only 19% of millennials say they can trust other people versus 40% for the boomers.
Wow. Is that why they put all their personal information on their Facebook
pages? Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. They drag all their personal information out in front of, 4 billion people, but they're still the most distrusting or mistrusting people in the United States today. This generation has record numbers of single parents, but also has the most negative attitudes towards single parents. Well, I guess that means they're most negative towards themselves.
The
most educated generation and the deepest in student loan debt and the least income potential. So that's bad news, too. The most educated and poorest generation starting out with the least potential for developing their income source. They're the less likely to identify as Republicans and Democrats, but they also have the highest approval rating of Congress, which is sort of odd. When you say they like Congress.
That's confusion right there.
Yeah. I don't get that. Millennials are much more liberal on homosexual marriage, evolution, marijuana, immigration, about the same as Gen Xers on abortion and gun ownership. Now, there is the rumor out there that Gen Xers are, or the millennials, are much more pro-life. Turns out they're not more pro-life. They're about the same. 56% of millennials think that abortion should be legal in all or most cases. 52% of boomers and 59% of Gen Xers think that abortion should be legal in all or most cases. So it's pretty much a flat line, very little difference on abortion. But they're much more liberal on homosexual marriage, on evolution, on socialism. They oppose benefit cuts to Social Security because they're very, very, very socialist. They love big government, but they don't think that there will be much money left in Social Security for them, and they oppose Obamacare. So, you know, I mean, figure that one out.
It's public education.
These people, somebody put their brains in blenders and turned it on high.
Yeah.
And by the way, one more thing. They don't consider themselves environmentalists. They're far less likely to be environmentalists than the boomers and the Gen Xers.
Wow.
They're
all over the place.
They're all over the place, yeah. They're all over the place. There's one thing you could say about millennials, they're really confused.
Yeah.
It's just, and you know, that makes sense. Because think about it, Steve. The millennials were raised in the postmodern age.
Yeah.
And postmodern relativism says what? What can we say about postmodern relativists?
There is no truth.
There is no truth. Yeah. You can't say anything certainly.
Right.
So in the same second, they could be pro-socialist and anti-socialist.
Right.
They could be pro-abortion and anti-abortion. They could be pro-homosexual marriage and anti-homosexual marriage within the same second. They could shift their position within a minute or two.
Because it was true a little bit ago doesn't mean it's true now.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, that was 60 seconds ago.
Yeah. I've changed my mind.
Yeah.
What mind I have left.
Right. So please understand, my friends, that the postmodern age is over the edge when it comes to the possibility of any absolute truth or ethics. And by the way, reality as well. They've abandoned reality. And in the end, Steve, I think they're going to abandon purpose because that's the last thing to go. Typically, that's the last thing to go before society commits suicide. You give up on the possibility of absolute truth. You give up on the possibility of absolute ethics. You give up on the possibility of absolute reality. That's at the point where you've really pretty much checked out.
Yeah. They still will look both ways before they cross the street, though.
Yeah. Well,
because the cars are still real.
But at the end, I guess they stop looking both ways.
Yeah.
I guess that's what happens.
Which
at the
is
end.
What's going on now.
Yeah. Okay. Be back in just a moment to talk more about the millennial generation. And how do we as Christians strategize for the future? What are we going to do politically? Especially when we discover that the millennial generation is far more likely to be liberal, socialist, pro-homosexual, pro-evolution than the previous generation. What are we going to do? Be back in just a moment. This is Generations. My name is Kevin Swanson.
Every year, Generations with Vision sponsors a family economics conference somewhere in America. This year, we are sponsoring a conference in Denver, Colorado on March 27 to 29, 2014. This is for families who want to reintegrate the family into a family economic vision, for families who want to find ways to mentor their sons and daughters into the family economy. This is just the conference for you. How do you choose the optimum business streams for your family? How do you integrate your children into the family economy? What about budgets and debt and capital investments? And what about inheritance and taking care of grandpa and grandma along the way? We'll have young entrepreneur panels, mom and daughter panels, retail and e-commerce panels, audience surveys, and some great keynote speakers, including family economics guru Alan Carlson and entrepreneur Dave Tucker, and yours truly, Kevin Swanson. Join us for our Family Economics Conference in our backyard, Denver, Colorado, March 27 to 29, 2014. Register today at FamilyEconomics.com.
Back on the Generations Radio broadcast today, Steve Vaughn also in studio with me, Kevin Swanson here, and friends, talking about the millennial generation. As we look through these studies done on the millennial generation, there's probably been 100 of them done. By the way, we're doing one more with Gen2Survey.com. That's coming up in just a couple of months. We should have some data out of that study later on. That has to do with those that are leaving the faith. We're trying to analyze the causes for young people leaving the faith. And right now we're looking at the largest migration out of the Christian church in the Western world that we've seen in 2,000 years. So it's a significant number of people walking away. Hey, church attendance dropping from 55% for the silent generation down to 18% for the millennial generation. For those who attend church on a regular basis, that's a big time drop. That's a 75% drop in a single generation. That's pretty impressive. We're trying to figure out why. And Steve, as we're looking through all of these surveys, not a lot of good news. I mean, this is bad news. Now, we need to say that there are exceptions to the rule. There is that minority, that significant minority that will make a difference. And they will set new directions.
That's
in the days and weeks and months and years to come. We have to bet on that.
Yeah, that's how God has always operated. He's never operated through the majority anyway.
Yeah.
He's always had his remnant, his minority that he works through. And and so there always is. There's always that 7,000 out there that hasn't bowed the knee to Baal.
Yeah, and typically Ahab times doesn't refer to the 7,000.
That's right.
It's going for the 94%.
Yes.
It's talking about the 94% of millennials and how many of them are excited about the Baal worship. Well, here's another article from theweek.com and LA Times that came out about a week ago. I just referred to an Atlantic Magazine article on millennials in the previous section. But now let's look at this other article called Why Are the Millennials Less Religious? And their church attendance, of course, much, much less than the silent generation and the boomers. Of course, it's been a slow fall off for a couple of generations now. But according to this article from theweek.com, it's no secret that young Americans aren't as religious as their elders. A survey released Wednesday by the Public Religion Research Institute suggests that part of that rift may be attributed to a perceived anti-gay bias in organized religion. Among those who have abandoned their childhood religion and are now religiously unaffiliated, one quarter say anti-gay teachings factored into their decision to go faithless. Among millennials and the religious turned irreligious camp, almost one-third said the same thing. As Pew Research pointed out, that generational divide isn't the result of just one or even a few factors. Rather, it coincides with the general softening of religious commitment in the nation as a whole, with religious institutions holding much less influence in Americans' daily lives. Americans attend church less, are more likely to doubt the existence of God, are less likely to take the Bible literally than ever before. What that means for millennials is that they're growing up in less religious households and are thus less liable to embrace religion themselves. Only 18% of Americans said they would vote for an atheist presidential candidate in 1958. A majority now say they would do just that. It's a big shift. And they did.
Yeah.
It's a good point. Yeah, they did. Although I think he's a Muslim.
Yeah.
Or he's an atheist or a Christian or maybe
he's everything.
Of all of that.
He wants to make sure he's set when he dies.
Yeah. As political scientists Robert Putnam and David Campbell tell in their book, American Grace, the Religious Right Secured a Foothold in Modern American Politics by Railing Against Abortion, Contraceptions, Premarital Sex, and Other Supposedly Sinful Things, including, yes, homosexuality. That politicization, they argue, then turned non-religious voters off of the GOP and religion in general. It should be no surprise that the solid majorities of millennials described Christianity as hypocritical and judgmental. And, okay, so that's it.
Yeah.
You know, and Steve, this brings up a lot of issues. But the first of which is this, that the millennials and America in general do not like dogmatism on any ethical issue. They don't want anybody to stand up in the middle of some university classroom and say, I believe that molesting small children is evil.
That's
the last thing in the world they want anybody to say.
Yeah, no absolutes.
No absolutes.
But the problem is that is an absolute.
I challenge somebody to stand up and say something like that in a university classroom today and just see what the response would be. It would be, I think, generally negative. Generally negative. There'd be a few that would say, yeah, I believe that that's wrong. Or you know, taking a two-year-old child and, you know, torturing the two-year-old child to death is wrong. Just standing up and saying, I believe that's wrong.
Yeah, everybody.
I think that generally speaking, in a postmodern university classroom, that would be deemed politically incorrect to make any ethical statement in a dogmatic way or an absolutistic way. That is anathema to the religion of the postmodern.
Yeah, the problem is, though, that everybody has their bright line. And I think if they were to stand up and say, yes, it's okay to torture a two-year-old, I think you would get some people say, I don't know. But, you know, so then
that's
you'd have
judgmental
to,
and hypocritical.
Right. Yeah, but then.
Right. Because, you know, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
That's judgmental. I mean, there are people out there that just get a kick out of torturing two-year-olds.
Yeah, they do.
So, I mean, who are you to impose your judgments on them?
That's the problem. That's the confusion.
That's the issue.
Yeah.
That's the issue. Right. Now, I know that about 40% of the class would come back and say, yeah, what he said. They would have to be forced to admit that there is something that is absolutely wrong. But, man, they have no basis for it.
Right,
just not a basis.
The bar keeps
nowhere.
Getting lowered, and eventually it'll be below that if it continues on.
Yep, it's too bad. Okay, well, what are the implications here, Steve? Let's talk a little bit about the implications of a society, an American society that's much less, quote-unquote, religious, much less likely to oppose homosexual marriage. What does this mean for Christians? I mean, Christians got involved in politics, specifically Republican politics in the 1980s and 1990s, thanks to Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and others. They got involved and they said, let's make a difference. Let's set a direction. Let's set a moral direction for the nation in the area of homosexuality and abortion. Well, for the most part, they failed.
Yeah.
For the most part, on a national level. Now, on a local level, as in the state of Texas last year, they were successful in shutting down some 19 abortion clinics, if I'm not mistaken. I'll check that article off in just a moment. But you know, where are we going to go from here? Does this mean that Christians should stay away from the homosexual and abortion issues when it comes to politics? That's the question I think we need to grapple with. And I've got some answers on this, but I think Christians are going to have to get their heads together and discuss this issue. Now, there are some who say that Christians should not involve the law of God in politics. And we call those the two kingdom types.
Right.
And there are maybe other descriptions for them, antinomians, other descriptions. But they're, as far as I'm concerned, they're wrong, because God imposes his law upon the ungodly nations of Babylon, Tyre and Sidon, Sodom and Gomorrah, throughout the entire Old Testament. And in Acts chapter 17, according to the Apostle Paul on Mars Hill, speaking to a bunch of pagans, God calls all men everywhere to repent, and he winked at a lot of the ignorant evil committed by pagan nations like Greece in the Old Testament. But according to Acts 17, he's holding these nations to a shorter account in the New Testament era than he did in the Old Testament era. And as I read it, he held these nations to moral account in the Old Testament.
Yeah, and some of them, you know, when you read these accounts, there were some that were very angry with what he said. There were some that wanted to hear more, mm-hmm. and there were some that believed. And so God does have people in these areas, and when God has his prophets come and hold them to account, there will be some that are called out.
Well, and I think that's my first point. Let's take a look at Elijah during the time of Ahab. This shows up in 1 Kings chapter, I think it's 17, 18, 19, somewhere in there. And Elijah is outnumbered.
Yeah, a lot.
Big time. Okay, it's virtually Elijah versus, you know, 1.6 million people on Carmel.
Yes.
It's the odds are significant against Elijah. And I would say that we're not in quite that state of affairs at this point in this nation's history. Granted, you know, we don't have a huge following ourselves. There aren't that many radio programs that are willing to talk pro-life, anti-homosexual agenda in the 21st century America. But there are a few radio programs broadcasting from basements across the United States. And I'm happy to say there are, you know, more than 7,000 across the United States that have not bowed a knee to Baal. Nevertheless, we're outnumbered. We are outnumbered. And the millennial generation, the next generation, our kids, your kids, will be outnumbered, Steve.
Yeah.
Have you told them that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
they will be outnumbered. And Elijah is going to be a good story for them because Elijah did continue to speak to a conscience of a nation, even though he was in a minority. When Ahab committed eminent domain on Naboth's vineyard,
right,
he was in his face. And yes, he was outnumbered. Yes, he risked his life a number of times, but he was willing to be what Al Mohler calls the prophetic minority, seeing as we're losing the moral majority. Al Mohler on this show said we will be the prophetic minority for the future, at least for the foreseeable future in this country. And we need to continue that piece. We need to continue to be a faithful prophetic minority in the midst of a nation that is going downhill and going downhill fast. Now, that takes guts. That takes faith and courage to be a prophetic minority. That's hard. It's hard when you're politically incorrect and you're risking imprisonment,
which
Elijah did, as did John the Baptist when he faced Herod with his sexual indiscretions.
Yeah, you have to be willing to risk it all, but then you have to dare to believe your beliefs that this life is not all there is, that if you belong to Christ, then you have forever to look forward to.
Amen.
And if they kill me, I win. If they let me live, I win. I mean, so either way we win, we have got to stand up for what we believe.
And if you get martyred, it puts an exponent on your total life impact.
That's right.
That's the good news. And so we've got every reason in the world to continue to be faithful in holding our leaders to account. And that means we need a voice down at the Capitol. Even if it is a single senator or a single House rep, we need a prophetic minority everywhere throughout society. And number one, I think we need it in order to hold these people to account. And if there is a God in the heavens, the fact that you had a prophet in that chamber standing up and preaching God's standards of morality will hold these people to account, and that will increase the culpability of every person who votes for abortion, every person that exalts abomination in those Senate chambers or anywhere else, or the voting booth or anywhere else. We need men willing to take the stand in the media, down at the Capitol, in those conference rooms. We need a prophetic minority everywhere to do the Elijah thing. Hey, if Elijah can do it, if John the Baptist can do it, hopefully there will be some men with guts to do it in the next 20, 30 years, even though we're grossly outnumbered.
That's right. But Elijah did have some success. There were a few times, you know, when he stopped the rain for the 3.5 years, he showed Baal had no power. But
oh, yeah.
Mount Carmel, we see a success.
Yeah, and that's my second point. Even though we're the prophetic minority, my second point is prepare for breakthrough. And that takes faith.
I mean, a lot.
You know, you're standing at the Red Sea. You're sort of outnumbered. Pharaoh's army, the greatest empire on earth, is descending on you. And this guy with a stick says, hey, check this out. Okay, that takes some faith.
Yes.
Prepare for breakthrough.
Yeah.
Prepare for breakthrough. I think we ought to tell our kids, prepare for breakthrough. They say, Dad, but we're way more outnumbered than you were. Tough. Okay, we're getting down to Gideon's 300. You know, we've whittled it down from 10,000 to 300. These are God's odds.
Yeah.
This is the way he likes to play.
Yeah.
So prepare for breakthrough. Encourage your children for the Elijah moment. Okay, thirdly, here's the third point. We may have to shift strategy at points. We may have to shift strategy at points. There may be a point at which you're just not going to be able to get a pro-life measure through the Colorado legislature. Doesn't mean you don't give up. Doesn't mean you give up. It doesn't mean you say, hey, we'll never, ever be able to do this again, but you may not be able to get it through in this session. Okay, if you can't get it through in this session, there's 20% of the House is pro-life, 80% pro-abortion. Yeah, the odds are against you. You probably aren't going to be able to pull off that particular issue, but there are things. There are standards of righteousness and justice for which you should fight, and you should continue to try to engage the battle at some level, at some battlefront, wherever you happen to be. Okay, the bad guys have pushed you back to the 20-yard line. Well, fight at the 20-yard line. They put you back to the 5-yard line. Okay, fight it out at the 5-yard line. The point is, you're going to have to adjust strategy depending on where you happen to be. I think of Obadiah during the period of Elijah. And here's a guy who's outnumbered. I mean, he's like Elijah. He's another good guy. And you read about this guy, Obadiah, during the reign of Ahab, which, by the way, is probably the worst king of Israel in the history of Old Testament Israel, making for a pretty good pattern for us.
Yeah.
Barack Obama, Ahab, Obama, Ahab.
Yeah, you know. Jezebel was more like Hillary, though.
Yeah, a little bit more. But 1 Kings 18, verse 3, Ahab called Obadiah, which was the governor of his house. Now, Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. Now, see, at that point, I'm like, dude, what's up with this? You know, this is like, you know, Barack Obama's right-hand man being some pro-life guy who fears God greatly. You know, it's sort of odd that this guy shows up, but this is the way God works. He puts some of the neatest guys in the most untoward circumstances. So here's Obadiah. He's the governor of the house of Ahab, which means I think he took care of his sheep and goats and cows and all that. So he kind of oversaw Ahab's economy. And then verse 4, it says, "For it was so when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord that Obadiah took 100 prophets, hid them by 50 in a cave, and fed them with bread and water." So that's a strategy. The guy didn't fight for the pro-life cause. He didn't fight for eliminating Baal from the land. You know, he could have fought certain other agenda items. He could have fought to remove the sodomites from the land, which is another agenda item that righteous governments engage. And you'll find that throughout the Kings and the Chronicles. But he didn't do any of that. But what he did do was what he could do.
Yeah.
Protected the people of God. He protected them. He made sure that they were not arrested and thrown in prison, or worse yet, killed at the hands of Ahab and Jezebel. Now, Steve, what I'm saying here is that there are points at which leaders who find themselves in the political magistrate can protect the people of God. They can keep pastors out of jail. They can keep these humble homeschooling fathers and mothers, the Romaikis of the world, out of prison.
Yeah.
Praise God.
Yeah, that was a good, that, you know, there was a breakthrough right there.
There was another breakthrough. Right, exactly.
So we are seeing that even in this age, that we do see these breakthroughs, and we need to be prepared for those, and we need to thank God for them, and we follow through on them and see if that can lead to something else.
I think just here's the message for our kids. That's what I'm trying to say. You know, how do we prepare them? I think the message is this. Prepare for success, prepare for victory, prepare for battle, and don't back away. And even if you are in the minority, God can bring about a tremendous victory in your lives. And if anything else, the millennial generation is the least connected, the most confused, and probably the least likely to want to get involved and lead a society into some kind of a sensible, stable social system. I don't think that's going to happen with most millennials.
Right.
They're so confused. They're so escaping. They're so unlikely to do anything but play video games in their parents' basement. That, Steve, I think it's the few that are engaged, the few that aren't completely addicted to the entertainment fest and smoking marijuana in downtown Denver. I think it's going to be our kids who have a concrete agenda of where to take this nation. They understand God's principles, and that becomes the beacon of light, and they are willing with wisdom and purpose and good judgment and courage and faith lead in that direction. I think that's going to be the solution for this nation's problems in 20, 30, 40 years from now, and it's for us to prepare our children for that vision.
Yeah, I see this on a weekly basis in my speech and debate clubs and at the tournaments I go to. I see these kids that do have an agenda. They have strength in their resolve. They know how to speak. They have the good, proper ideas, and these are the ones that are going to they're going to be the ones that are leading the nation in this next generation.
Give your kids a vision, friends. Give them a vision. Without a vision, the people perish. Give them a direction. Show them some history. Teach them the history and teach them the principles of God's word and how to bring those principles to bear in the civil magistrate. That's why I wrote my book, The Second Mayflower, which gives us a vision for where we're going to go. Got to go somewhere. Can't just sit in a prison cell and rot to death. I mean, that's not really the vision for life. The vision for life is to disciple the nations and take this nation somewhere by the year 2040, 2050, 2080. So grab a copy of my book, The Second Mayflower. Flower available at our website. Be sure to get copies for your children and grandchildren, because they're gonna need a vision, for a direction to go. for the years to come. And of course, we draw heavily from the principles of Scripture, but also from the principles that were laid down by those who founded this nation so many years ago. Grab a copy of my book, The Second Mayflower, at kevinswanson.com now. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.